Take it home later, get a little depressed and read it later. It's very beautiful. About somebody being taken away, taken to the concentration camps, actually being brought to the ghetto, and having that last second, what do you take with you? What is so important to you? And if you only have 1 minute to grab something from your home, what prized possession would you take with you? And the story that I put on the handout was a woman who took her candelabra that she lit Shabbat candles from every Friday night, that she got from her parents and from their parents, because that meant so much to her, the observance of Shabbat. But I want to share with you a little lighter story that also has to do with Shabbos that I received as an email just a few years ago. And I'm just going to read you the email. As I settled into my seat on flight 1272 bound for Chicago, I glanced at the passengers filing down the aisle. My Jew radar immediately went off, in addition to the business travelers totting their laptops, briefcases, and the pleasure travelers wearing shorts. I spied several suede kippot and ankle-length skirts. Despite our shared heritage, I didn't bother acknowledging them. They were strangers. And I live in New York, where strangers seldom exchange greetings, except for Manhattan Jewish experience, of course. The plane rolled down the runway and I waited for the takeoff. No such luck. The pilot announced that the flight was being delayed 3 hours due to stormy weather conditions in Chicago. I glanced at my watch nervously. Usually I avoid flying on Friday afternoon for fear I won't arrive on time. But summer weekends, when Shabbat doesn't begin till like 8 p.m., I figured, no problem. I figured wrong. But I calculated I could just make it if I didn't claim my luggage and jumped into a taxi. I turned around to check on my co-religionists. Two kippot were examining their watches. The chassid was on the airphone. A half hour before arrival, the pilot announced O'Hara Airport was shut down. We were landing in Milwaukee until we could continue on. My stomach sank. Candlelighting was an hour away. I'd never make it on time. Like most religious Jews who work in the secular world, I'd experienced my share of close calls, but I never knowingly violated the Sabbath. And now I was stuck. By now, the kippot and long skirts were huddled in the back of the plane. They had been joined by others. Shabbat was bringing strangers together. It was time to introduce myself. We're going off to Milwaukee, a young man told me. The chassid had called Milwaukee's Chabad rabbi, who offered to host any stranded passengers for Shabbat. Come with us, he urged. I nodded with relief, but returned to my seat crestfallen since I'd planned this weekend with my family for months. My non-Jewish seatmate, noticing my despair, inquired what was wrong, and when I told him the story, his jaw dropped. Let me get this straight, he said. You're getting off the plane in a town you've never been with people you don't know to stay overnight with complete strangers. For the first time that day, it occurred to me just how lucky I was. When the plane landed, the pilot announced that we were disembarking for religious reasons. Passengers stared at us dumbfounded. My seatmate bid me farewell as if he didn't think I would survive. But I quickly realized I was among friends. As I attempted to carry my bags off the plane, a woman insisted on helping me. When we crowded into cabs to take us to the rabbi's house, the chassid insisted on paying for me. And when the cabs pulled up at the home of the rabbi in the Rebbetzin, they ran outside to greet us as if we were long-lost relatives. The sun set on Milwaukee as they ushered us into that home where a long table was set for Shabbat with a white tablecloth, china, and gleaming kiddush cups. When I lit the Shabbat candles, a wave of peace washed over me. With all that had transpired, I was warmed by the notion that the world stops with the first flicker of the Sabbath light. Over a traditional Shabbat feast, the rabbi enchanted us with tales of the Baal Shem Tov that was the founder of the Hasidic movement and informed us that our reroute to Milwaukee was not due to the world of weather, but of divine providence. We lingered over our meal, enjoying our spiritual sanctuary and time after the stressful day. We sang Shabbat songs. We shared disappointments about our unexpected stopover. Most of the group was traveling to Chicago for a friend's afruf, that's the calling up of the groom to the Torah on the Shabbat before his wedding, and they were missing the wedding, and they were missing the afruf. The chassid and his wife were missing a bar mitzvah. We pondered the meaning of the departure from our journey and marveled at the coincidences. I had attended camp with my roommate. A couple had conducted business with my father. A man had studied in yeshiva with my cousin. The chassid used to work in my hometown of Aurora, Illinois. And I'd once spent Purim in Crown Heights with my host's son. Exhausted as we were, it's Jewish geography, everyone was hesitant to leave the table to go to sleep. The next morning, a lively prayer service was followed by a leisurely meal where we exchanged stories about our lives, careers, and dreams. We nicknamed ourselves the Milwaukee 15 and wondered if future generations would retell the story of the flight that didn't make it in time for candlelighting. Saturday night, we made a regretful journey to the everyday world. But before we began the final leg of our journey, I called my husband to tell him everything that had transpired. "Who did you spend Shabbat with?" he asked worriedly. I pondered how to explain who these former strangers were who had given me object lessons in Shabbat hospitality and in the power of Shabbat in bringing Jews together. Then as swiftly as a 747 could leave the tarmac on a clear day, I realized the truth. Miles away from my parents, my husband, and my home, I had accomplished what I set out to do when I first booked my ticket. I'd spent Shabbat with family. It's beautiful. Gorgeous, huh? I just saw this. Somebody sent this to me a couple of years ago. And I wanted to begin our discussion about Shabbat because, you know, there's a famous line by the great Hebrew poet Achan Ha'am. There are streets named after him in Israel. And he famously remarked, "More than the Jew has kept the Sabbath has kept the Jew." And I want to explore that with you tonight. What is it about Shabbat that so keeps the Jewish people connected? You know, out of all of the 613 commandments in the Torah, there is no other commandment, there is no other mitzvah that so much hinges on in Judaism. More Jews have come into Judaism through the observance of the Sabbath. More Jews have left Judaism through the abandonment of the Sabbath than any other commandment in the Torah. In fact, if you open up the Talmud and you want to know the different types of Jews, you will find no reference in the Talmud to Orthodox Jews, Reformed Jews, Conservative Jews, Apple Jews, Orange Jews, no types of Jews. There's only one distinction between different types of Jews: Jews who keep the Shabbat and Jews who do not. And there are so many other types of references and distinctions. So, of course, one of the Ten Commandments, to the observance of the Sabbath. Talmud says that if every Jew kept two Sabbaths, even though there's a famous song, "Just one Shabbos," and it was wrong, it's actually two, but whatever, it's still a very famous song. Talmud says that if every Jew kept two Sabbaths, the Messiah would certainly come. And Rabbi Danin, in his famous book, To Be a Jew, says, and I quote, "No other commandment in the Torah receives such expressions and descriptions of affection and devotion as the Sabbath. It's the only observance which is personified in the religious poetry of the prayers, and explaining it," he writes, "is like describing a sunset to someone who is unfortunately blind." So what is it about Shabbos that is so significant? Well, I kind of answered some of the question with a story up front, because it's just an immediate community builder. You will feel immediately part of a community when you start observing the Sabbath. It just does it. Because, first of all, you got to eat the meals. We're going to go through it. There's three meals, so you don't want to eat them alone. So by definition, you're going to either invite someone or you're going to get invited. And then you maybe want to do some special Sabbath praying. And then that brings you to synagogue. And then even the meals, you know, at my home, and you're all invited, hope to get each and every one of you at some point to our home for a Shabbat meal. So we always go around the Shabbat table and everybody gets to get to know each other, because we have a lot of strangers, not strange people, but strangers at our Shabbat table. People don't know each other. So he's asked, you know, like, the conversation around a Shabbat table is always a little different. It's a little more elevated. We try to get to know each other a little more. First of all, and I will tell you as a parent, the biggest difference between my Shabbat meal and, I don't know, dinner that I just had with my family, which is lovely on a Monday night, is this. Because when this gets brought to the table, it's very hard to stay focused on other people. And I remember years ago I went to, I used to be involved in an organization called NCSY, National Conference Synagogue Youth, and used to run these Shabbatons for like high school kids, out-of-towners. And we put on a skit. Actually, the kids put on a skit. It was brilliant. High school kids. Of like a family celebrating the Sabbath. But they were trying to make a point. Meaning that the father was making the Kiddush, the mother was like breaking the bread for challah, and everything was really nice, except everyone was allowed to bring their technology to the table. So one guy was on, and one kid was on his laptop, the other one was like playing video games on his phone. The phone rang in the middle, somebody started having a conversation with somebody else, and you know, and the father was like so frustrated, and the mother, like they were trying to. So, you know, I have found that in the 21st century, selling Shabbat has gotten easier than ever. Because people around the world, Jewish and non-Jews alike, are doing these sort of detox days where you have like retreats on a firm and you have to put your box, your phone in a black box. You can't look at it. And it's like this new innovative idea that Jews have been talking about for thousands of years. And it doesn't cost anything, you know. You know, these expensive retreats where people go to where you can't, you know, technology detox. So it's really an unbelievable community building thing. Now, what are we celebrating though? Does anybody know? And that's what you'll find on page 2 of your handout. But even before looking at what is it, what exactly are we celebrating on Shabbat? Okay, so in other words, we're commemorating, number one, God created the world in how many days?
Six.
Six, and then what did he do on the seventh? That's fine.
Rested.
He rested. And by the way, I'm glad you pointed that out. And Jordan, I'll take your question in a minute. Does anybody know what the Torah actually says? Take a look. For in 6 days, God made heaven and the earth and the sea and all that was in them and rested on the seventh day. Now, it's interesting. Another verse in the Torah says, Vayichulu, and we make the Kiddush on Friday night. We say, Vayichulu Hashemayim Baretz V'chol Tzva'am. And God finished all of His creation and everything that was in it. Vayichalu Kimet Yom HaShvi'i Melachto Asher Asah. It says that God finished creating on the seventh day. What should it say? What should the Torah say? God finished creating on the sixth day. He stopped creating and He rested on the seventh day. But the Torah doesn't say that. The Torah says that God stopped creating on the seventh day, implying that something else was created on the seventh day. What's that?
Shabbat.
And this is a very different way of thinking of the Sabbath. That, and I was raised to observe Shabbat, but this resonates with me, which is that rest in the way that we're trying to achieve on Shabbat is not the way we normally in the Western world think of rest. When you think of rest, what do you think about?
Sleeping.
Sleeping? Or just chilling, like total like disengagement, like, I don't know, sipping a tequila by like an ocean and just being, right? Or it's total rest. Rest in Judaism is a much deeper thing. The word Shabbat itself is linguistically connected to the word Shevet, same letters. Shin, Bet, Tav. Shabbat, La Shevet. What does it mean, La Shevet? To sit. Vakasha, La Shevet. Please have a seat. What does sitting have to do with the Sabbath, Shabbat? And the Kabbalists teach that all week long there's a certain tension in the world. There's a tension between the physical and the spiritual worlds. There's a tension between the Ein Sof, which is God's ultimate spiritual energy, and physical matter. And you probably experience it, all of us do. The part of us that's drawn to the spiritual, part of us that wants to submit to something greater than ourselves. And then there's a part of us that's very physical, is the animal part of who we are, that wants to eat and that wants to just enjoy, that wants to conquer, subdue the forces of nature, build a better world, and go out there and really conquer. There's this tension. Rabbi Soloveitchik, I quoted this from his book last week. I'll say it again in his famous book, Lonely Man of Faith. He talks about these two forces within each of us. In chapter 1 and chapter 2 of the book of Genesis. Adam 1, we talked about a few weeks ago in our relationship class. Try to bring things together a little. Adam 1 was told what? Vikiv Shuha, which means lechvosh, means to conquer. To conquer the forces of nature, to build hospitals, to create cures, to not simply accept the world as it is. God created an imperfect world and commanded us to make it better. That's for the first 6 days. On the seventh day, no more. We pull back. And that's Adam 2. We submit to something greater, but it's not simply just going to sleep. A lot of people think that. Shabbos is such a smart idea. Sharpening the saw. You know that expression? You've got to sharpen the saw or else you're going to be no good to anyone. Now that's true, and that's one of the benefits of keeping Shabbat. But the reason we keep Shabbos is not so we could be better on Monday. And Rabbi Abraham Heschel, one of the great Jewish thinkers, said that Shabbat is the day that inspires all the other days. Not just so that we could be better physically, but that we can inform the rest of our week with spiritual purpose. You know, there's a little custom when you make Havdalah, which is the concluding ceremony of Shabbat. You ever see like people pour a little too much wine in there? Like it overflows. It's done purposely. There's such a custom. The idea is that the blessing of Shabbos, represented by the wine, is supposed to spill over into the week. Which is why we end our daily prayers every single day. We say, Hayom Yom Shabbat Kodesh, Hayom Yom Rishon B'Shabbat, Shabbo Hayu Halavim Omrim B'Veit HaMikdash. Today is the first day of the Shabbos that the Levites would recite the psalm on the day of that week. Today is the second day of Shabbat. Every day is in relation to Shabbat. Because Shabbat is not just for that one day of the week. Shabbat literally changes your life all week long. It informs and it inspires every single day. It gives us purpose and meaning, and it forces us to look at ourselves. As the famous Socrates said this, that the unexamined life is never worth living. You know, it's very hard to look at yourself when you're looking at this all the time. And that doesn't mean we're bad. This is part of Vikiv Shua. This is part of conquering the force of nature, making the world a better place, to be able to communicate faster. And we could do so many more things today because of this. I'm not trying to knock this all the time. This is good. But it's not always good. And we need that balance. And to be able to then use this in the best possible way, not to lose ourselves through this, but to use it productively, constructively. Right? We need purpose, and we need some kind of approach. And that's what Shabbos, I'll take your question in a minute, Shabbos is really there to force us to look at ourselves and look at our lives and ask us, okay, take a breather, what happened this week? What's going on next week? And how can I somehow live in accordance with my purpose and meaning? And that is emulating 6 days. And I'll just mention one other point, then I'll take your question. Take a look at the second reason the Torah gives for keeping Shabbos. First is to emulate creation. And what did we say about creation? God didn't just not do anything on the seventh. He created rest, a harmony between the spiritual and physical worlds. We have that harmony between the physical and spiritual worlds on Shabbat. But one other thing. What's the other thing we remember on Shabbos? What's that?
Mm-hmm. With a mighty hand and with an outstretched arm. Therefore, to God, your God, commanded to observe the Sabbath.
Okay. Why do we have to remember the Exodus so much? And what does it have to do with keeping Shabbos? I mean, I get creation. But what does the Exodus have to do with Shabbat?
They did not rest before.
Okay, good. Number one, as slaves, our ancestors were unable to really rest. And what else? They were not really in control of what? What's that?
Their time.
And that's really what Shabbos comes to elevate. How do we sanctify space in Judaism? What institution of Jewish life comes to sanctify space, physical space? That's the temple. Today we have our synagogues. What sanctifies time? And that is Shabbat. And that's the connection, one of the connections to the fact that we used to be slaves because when you are a slave and you're literally owned by someone else, your time is not your time. Does anybody know the first mitzvah historically given to the Jewish people? What was the first mitzvah the Jewish people as a nation received? It was the mitzvah of Rosh Chodesh. I'm sorry, I'm eating pizza while I'm teaching. It's very unprofessional. Rosh Chodesh is the new moon. Because that's how we create our calendar. We never had our own calendar. What do you need a calendar for? You just, your boss tells you what to do, where to go, what time to get up, what time to go to bed. No. That's not what we have. We're in control. We made a decision to accept a position. We voluntarily accepted this job. We knew what we were getting ourselves into. And then we say, well, I'm enslaved. I have no control. My boss is a jerk. I don't know. It's just so difficult. But we all have choices. And we voluntarily chose this. Unlike our ancestors who were enslaved and forced to do this. And one other thing I want to mention, then I'll take your question. This is a very fundamental Jewish idea, which is that we not only believe in God, but what kind of God do we believe in Judaism, classically? It's a God that we believe continues to intervene in the world. Now, the Kabbalah goes crazy on this, because the difference between the way you and I create and the way God created necessitates God's continued intervention. See, when we create from pre-existing matter, and let's say I've made this beautiful chair, very attractive, it's very functional, I make the chair, I put it here, and then I had enough, and I go into the other room, I completely forget about this chair that I've created. What happens to the chair? Nothing. It just stays the same unless someone breaks it. Let's say I quit MG, I travel to New Zealand, and I never come back to New York. What happens to the chair? Still stays. It has. I can have no relationship with that chair, and it can continue to exist. Not so the Kabbalists teach when God creates, because God creates what's called in Hebrew Yesh Ma'ayin, something from nothing. And when something is created from nothing, are you guys cold?
Yes.
You know, that's the. That's the halacha, you know. If there's one person cold in the room, unless people are going to like pass out from the heat, then you're supposed to follow that person. You know why that is? Because you can get sick from sitting in the cold too long, but you can't get sick from sitting in too much heat. That's what the Talmud says. Anyway, so God creates from nothing and therefore has to continue to pump that item with his spiritual energy, which means that we subscribe to the idea that God didn't just create the world at one point in history, set it on automatic timer, and take off. Like everyone thinks, you know, God created the world, and now he's just too busy to deal with us. We have a fundamental belief in Torah, in classical Judaism, that God stays involved in our lives. And the moment he stops paying attention to us is the moment we stop existing. The Mekubalim, the Kabbalists, teach that we would return to the primordial tohu vavohu, chaos and disorder, that the Torah describes the world before it was created, unless God continues to relate to us. And that's another idea that Shabbat comes to demonstrate. Not only that God created the world, but that he continues to intervene in the world. What does that have to do with the Exodus? Because the Exodus from Egypt was the first time that God ever showed his hand in history. An oppressed, victimized, enslaved people called out for God, and God came. And God responded and said, I'm here, I'm going to take you out. Now why, and this is interesting, welcome, why is it, here's one. You know, why is it that, why is it that God, you know, chose to intervene here and not there? Why did he rescue our ancestors from Egypt but remain silent during the Holocaust? That's a very legitimate question, which I'm not going to deal with right now. But the fact that it's a question bespeaks a certain belief that we have, which is that God cares. that God's powerful, that God's aware of what's happening, and that He can intervene if He so chooses. Or else nobody would have a problem with God's silence in the face of the Shoah, of the Holocaust. The only reason we have a problem is because we subscribe to a benevolent, all-powerful God. If you didn't think God was powerful enough to put the Nazis down, or he didn't care enough, you know, to rescue European Jewry, we wouldn't be troubled by that question. We're all troubled by that question. It's the number one question of the 20th century, lingered into the 21st century. But that demonstrates that deep down we really believe not only in a God who once created the world, but a God who continues to intervene, and that was the Exodus. That was the first time that God did so. So that's a very, very important idea. Okay, you had a question, Lindsay.
It wasn't so much a question. I was just thinking that I wanted to maybe share this shiur with a friend, and you kept referring to this when you were talking about your phone, and I just wanted you to reference that it was your phone so that when I shared the recording, they would know what you were talking about.
Oh, okay. I got you. Thank you. Thank you. Any other questions about anything I've mentioned so far? Yeah.
So you say that Hashem is watching us all of our lives until we pass away. Wouldn't he... What's
not simply watching.
Elaborate that. Can you?
God is continually directing His attention and pumping His spiritual energy, enabling us to continue to exist. And not just people, but all forms of human existence, which are four of which. There's mineral, there's plant, there's animal, there's human. All four parts of the physical created world, the Kabbalists teach, have to have the constant spiritual injection of God's spiritual energy in order for them to continue to be.
Does it also include our own neshama, our soul too?
Yeah, of course.
I was expecting that to be thrown in there too. Like after our passing, our souls will also be pumped with this kind of redundant but spiritual energy to our own spirits when we pass away.
Correct. Right, that gets a little more complicated. Because we do believe that the soul is somehow an outgrowth of God Himself. But as long as the soul is encased within the body here in the physical world, God has to continue to direct His attention and inspire that being, which is a composite of both body and soul, with God's energy. What happens after we're a disembodied soul in the next world?
That's a little more complicated.
That's a little different. It might not require the same kind of attention that the soul does in the physical world. That's a good point, though. All right, we're getting deep here. Any other comments or questions about the Sabbath, Shabbat? All right, let's move on a little. So these are two ideas that I wanted to share having to do with Shabbat. What I would like to do right now with you is take you through a Sabbath. So let's turn the page, actually. Sorry about that. Skip with me, please, on page 6. The Torah tells us that there is basically two things that we do on Shabbat. Things that we do and things that we don't do. Where do we learn these things from? A very famous verse in the Torah. Zachor et yom ha-Shabbat lekadsho. Let's see if I have it here. Actually, go back to page 2. The last paragraph. There are four dimensions to the observance of the Sabbath, two originating in the Torah and two originating in the words of our sages. So there's actually four things, two biblical and two rabbinic. What are the biblical? The two dimensions originating in the Torah are the commandments, remember the Sabbath day and observe or guard the Sabbath day. So which one do you think refers to the positive aspects of Shabbat, things we're supposed to do, as opposed to things we're supposed to try to refrain from doing? Which one? Which word? Remember versus guard. Which is which? What do you guys think?
Remember and observe.
So So which is which? Which one do you think?
Remember is what? Is that a positive? Well, give me an example of something positive we do on Shabbat. You know what I'm saying? Maybe I'm not being clear. We make kiddush. We have two loaves of bread on the table. We do all these things to, right? That comes from the phrase Zachor et Yom HaShabbat L'Kadsho. Remember the Sabbath to keep it holy. There's another verse in the Torah that says Shamor et Yom HaShabbat L'Kadsho. What's Shamor? Shamor means to guard. If you you're on guard duty in Israel, let's say in the army, they call it Shmirah. What does it mean to guard? It means you're protecting something from being violated. And that refers specifically to, anybody know? What are the things that we refrain from doing on the Sabbath? What don't we do on Shabbat?
Work.
We don't do work. Okay, now what is that? Okay, so work is also not understood in the general way that normally we talk about work. Because work usually means what in Western parlance?
Job,
employment. Now, we try not to go to work on Shabbat too, but it's not. But that is actually technically only rabbinically forbidden. Going to your job. What are we really refraining from doing on the Shabbat?
And that is engaging in what kind of activities? You mentioned
work that implies change.
Oh.
Good.
Okay, work that implies change in some kind of way, specifically defined as 39 activities that were necessary to both build or maintain the tabernacle. What was the tabernacle?
Tabernacle was like that mobile sanctuary that our ancestors traveled around the wilderness with until we had a permanent temple in Jerusalem. The Mishkan, it's called in Hebrew. The activities that went into building that, taking it, putting it up, taking it down, because it was moved around, and it would be folded up, so to speak, and then undone. They would use it, and then they would pack it up and move it to another place. The activities involved, all of those activities involved some kind of, give me some examples. Does anybody know, what's an example of any one of the melachot, the things from which we refrain from doing? Yeah? Good, so that's a good example. Anyone ever build like a sukkah? Or Jews aren't really good builders. We usually hire other people to do this. But you ever like build something and you want to know where this thing goes and that thing goes, so you put a little X here and a little X there? That's exactly what you were saying. So that's how writing became something from which we refrain from doing on Shabbat. It has very little to do with what we normally think about work. Like, for example, like this stack of chairs right over there. Let's say I'm having people to my home on Shabbat. And I have to, like, schlep in those stack of chairs and then put them out and carry the dishes in and carry the dishes out and get something to drink and I'm serving my 20 guests. What does that sound like? It sounds like something many of us do every Shabbos. How does that not work? And yet, if I go over to that light switch and I just flick, I go over to this, watch this. That was tough. I'm exhausted. Why is that breaking the Sabbath? And schlepping those chairs is not.
It's the change of the fire of life.
Because here I have... Were you going to say that?
I was going to go more into detail.
Yeah,
that's the simplest you could put it here.
Yeah.
What are you doing? What is happening
here? You're creating something.
You're creating something. You are manipulating the forces of nature to effect some kind of change. Actually only and that's why am I doing that if I take a bunch of chairs? Let's say none of these chairs or tables were in this room and it's Shabbos and I wanted to have like nice tables and chairs for people to come out. Can I go into the kitchen, grab all the tables, all the chairs? Let's say it took me 2 hours. Is that okay?
Yes.
It's a trick question. Feels wrong, but it's actually technically perfectly okay. Why? Because I haven't changed anything. This table is this table. Just opening it up and closing it is not... Now, you could start getting closer to doing change. What's another example of one of the 39 acts of work from which we refrain? Yeah?
Burning of nuts.
a knot. Right? So if I make a knot, now, that means you have to walk around with your shoelaces open on Shabbos? So you could do a little knot, not a permanent knot. Okay, because that it's only a permanent knot that's actually a problem. What about plowing? I know that's hard for you, many of you to refrain from doing here in Manhattan, but you're not supposed to plow on Shabbos. Now you're laughing. You're laughing, but I'm going to show you here, for example, how you can actually plow on Shabbos. These chairs have been very, very helpful. So I'm visiting a friend in Central Park. You got to check out the Great Lawn in Central Park if you're on the Upper West Side. And then, like, I'm getting tired and standing out here looking for somebody normal to talk to for the last 2 hours. And so finally, I find a chair, and my friends are standing over there, so I just grab the chair, and I pull it over here. What was that? That was actually plowing, if I turned over some soil. Now, it wasn't like an animal with a plow on its neck, you know, schlepping along, but it doesn't matter. It's turning over the soil for the purpose of seeding and creating, you know, plants. So on the biblical level, it's probably not plowing, because in order to really be plowing, you're really supposed to be doing it but rabbinically, it is considered plowing. So every one of those 39 melachot, even though they seem archaic and old, are all involved somehow with real activities. And when you study to become a rabbi, which I'm sure you'll all start after this basic Judaism class is over, that's one of the things you spend a lot of time doing, which is learning how to answer these questions. Can anyone tell me the most subtle of melachot, of the 39 acts of work, that really doesn't seem like it's changing anything, though? Because like a knot, you could say it's changing. This is changing. That's changing. What is something we don't do on Shabbat that doesn't seem to really involve any real change? Yeah.
Can it be smearing?
Well, smearing you are, because you are changing. If I take some, what am I taking here?
Washing.
What?
I'm sorry.
Now you're changing its form, so you are doing something to change. Yeah, that's why we don't use like a regular bar of soap. We'll use liquid soap on Shabbat if you're following these rules. What else? What were we gonna say?
You said change shape, so I was gonna say cut something with scissors, for
example. Yeah, that would be a change.
That's still the same thing.
What about this?
Carrying.
Well, forget the money for a minute, because the money. If I put something in my pocket. And I didn't remember it's there. That's considered carrying unless I have what's called an erev, and I'm not getting into all these rules and laws. All I'm trying to demonstrate, though, is that the rabbis teach that carrying is forbidden because it's the way that classically we engage in our commerce, in our business, by transferring items, products, from one domain to the next. So that's more of moving things, you know, from one thing to the next. But I want to get back. So that's the things that we don't do on Shabbat, and the things that we do. Turn the page, please. Let's run through a quick Shabbos. Turn to page 6 on top. Shabbos actually starts before Shabbat. Does anybody know? What do we do on Shabbos before Shabbos? What do we do before Shabbos to get ready for Shabbat?
Light candles.
Even before that. That's how we bring in Shabbos. We pray, yeah, but Shabbat, we always pray. But we do the Shabbat prayers when Shabbos starts.
We prepare.
What do we prepare? What do we do? We bake. We cook. Right? One of the things we don't do on Shabbat is cook, so everything has to be prepared from beforehand. What else do we do? Why do we do this beforehand, by the way? Why is it important not to wait till Shabbos starts to do these things?
You can't do it during Shabbat.
Why not?
Because you're not allowed to work.
So you can't do work. So let's say some things are not work. Let's say, can I set the table on Shabbos?
You can't bake on Shabbos.
That's correct, but I can set the table. I'm not changing anything. But when do we really try to set the table?
You want to set the table and prepare everything before your guests arrive. So you will want to prepare everything and have it assembled before Malta or Shabbat
arrives. Okay, so I want you to think of it like this. Shabbat is really an honored guest that you've invited into your home. The rabbis treat the Shabbat like a personality. So imagine an important person you've invited to your home for dinner at 7. President is coming to your home at 7 p.m.
doorbell rings. What a great honor, Mr. President, come. And please have a, you know, just give me a few minutes. I need to get the table set. Now, that could be like an international incident that, you know, like another head of state didn't have the table set for the president. It's like a diss. What do you mean? I'm the president of the United States. And you're going to have me sit here while you get the... You couldn't do this before. What does it demonstrate if we didn't do it before? That means we're not excited. We're not prepared for the honored guest. And that's really what we try to do before Shabbat. A couple of things. We take a shower.
Yeah.
Get dressed. Put on some nice clothing. Always try to have special Shabbat clothing. I don't know if you know this. You want to have something a little different than you would wear during the week. A little nicer, a little different. When I was a kid, I was always wearing glasses. My mother, blessed memory, I used to have special Shabbat frames. I only wore them on Shabbos. They were my John Lennon round ones, little gold frames. I had a special Shabbat yarmulke. I only wore that on the weekends. I had special Shabbos socks, and I realized they weren't really special Shabbos socks. They were just dark, because when you're a kid, you know who wears dark. Okay, whatever. So those were things that were sort of set aside. Maimonides actually tells us that if a person is so poor that they don't have another article of clothing that they can set aside for Shabbat, then they should take something they wear during the week and try to wear it a little differently. Pull it down a little further, try to make it a little better. Rabbi Soloveitchik told the story, one of the great rabbis of the 20th century. He was raised in a very poor shtetl, basically, in Poland. And he said there was a man, his name was Yankel, he was a water carrier. His job was literally to schlep water. And he was so poor, he said, that like when you would see him during the week, there were like more holes than material in his clothing. He says, but when you would see him seated at his own Shabbos table, he was like regal. He looked like a king. Shabbos, it doesn't matter who you are during the week. That one day of the week, you bring out the best. Now, Aliyah mentioned, if you take a look at number 2, we light the Shabbat candles to usher in the Shabbat. Why are we lighting Shabbat candles? For 2 reasons. Number 1, a gloomy home is not a home that you want to be in on Shabbat. You want a home that's lit. And that's why there is a tradition, I don't know how many of you light Shabbat candles, but I'm going to give you a little trick. But Moshe Feinstein, one of the great halachic decisors of the last generation, suggested that since today we don't really light our homes with candles, this is the way we light our homes today, what you really should do before you light the Shabbat candle is turn a light off, an electric light off, and then on for the sake of Shabbat. Because the Shabbat candle is really supposed to illuminate the house. And if you live in an apartment, whatever it is, you really should just make sure before you start Shabbat that there's going to be some light on, you know, in the apartment on Shabbat, because a gloomy home is not a Shabbos home. And we of course light before the Sabbath comes in, because as we mentioned before, it's one of the 39 acts of work. It's one of the things we refrain from doing on Shabbat. It's manipulating, obviously, the physical environment in a real way. And there you have the blessing on the bottom of page 6. Baruch atah Hashem Elokeinu melech haolam, blessed are you, God, King of the universe, asher kidushanu b'mitzvotav v'tzivanu, who has sanctified us and commanded us, lahadlik ner shel Shabbat, to light the Sabbath candle. Okay? And then there's a tradition to come to synagogue. I invite you all to MJE on Friday nights. Every Friday night at 6:30 we have FNL, Friday Night Lights. It's awesome. Just about a 45-minute to an hour long. It's not a long service. We use the tunes of the late and great Shlomo Carbach, and then we come in here and eat sushi. I don't know when that became a Jewish tradition, but it's ours. If you have children, there's a tradition to bless them on Friday night. If you don't have children, please don't take anyone else's and just bless them. It just would be weird. Turn the page to page 8, Friday night. At the table, we come home and we make what's called Kiddush. Who doesn't love Kiddush? I'm going to have some myself. We fill up a cup with wine. Why do we use wine, by the way? Very deep answer. This is really good. That's it. The main reason we use wine is because it's the most distinguished beverage we have.
Isn't it supposed to be grapes as well?
It should be from grapes, so you can use grape juice if you need to stay away from alcohol, for whatever reason. And
Yeah, and you can take a look on page 8. I'm not going to go through the whole Kiddush with you, but there are three parts to the Kiddush. The first part speaks of what we mentioned before. God created the world in 6 days, rested on the seventh. Then we have the blessing over the wine. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu melech haolam barei pri hagefen. Nice. And then the blessing of sanctification. Does everyone at the table make the Kiddush? No, it's fine just for one person. It's actually better for one dude or dudette to make the Kiddush at the table and keep everyone else in mind, because the more people that congregate around one mitzvah, the better. Okay, so that's making Kiddush. Any questions about lighting candles or making Kiddush? We're flying now, guys. We're going through Shabbos. Any questions, comments, suggestions? Yes, Jordan.
Why is it that the parents bless the children, but it's only until Birkat that the children bless the parents?
That it's only until
Birkat that the children bless
the
parents.
Oh, children never bless their parents. That's a little presumptuous. At Birkat HaMazon, what Jordan is referring to is at the end of the meal, we say grace after meals. Any meal we had bread. So then if your parents are sitting at the table, you have to recognize them. By the way, you're supposed to do that anytime. If you're giving a speech and your dad's in the room or your mom's there, you're supposed to say, with the permission of my mother and my father. There is such a tradition of showing honor to a parent by recognizing their presence. That's all you're really doing at the beginning of Birkat HaMazon, grace after meals, by mentioning the parents. You're not blessing them, you're recognizing them. What the parents are really doing is they're bestowing a bracha. Did anyone have this in their home Friday nights? That their parents, you guys have this? It actually was a custom that was prevalent only before Yom Kippur. When I was a kid, we only got it before Yom Kippur. And then my mother found out, like all these other families were doing it. My father was okay with it because it didn't cost anything. When I was like 14 or 15, my parents started giving us a blessing on Friday night. It's very, very beautiful. I look forward to it. Please God, everyone should merit to be able to do that. So after you make the Kiddush, what happens then? You go and have, how many loaves of bread? Two loaves of bread. Why? That is way svarti. I've never seen Ashkenazim kiss a rabbi's hand. I always wanted to be a svarti rabbi, because svarti rabbis get so much more honor than Ashkenazi rabbis. Ashkenazi rabbis get beaten up by their svarti rabbis. They're like kissing their hand. They're like bowing before them. What can I do for you, old great rabbi? I'm making a joke, but like there's some truth to it.
Like one time when I was in Jerusalem, I forget, we were praying Kabbalah about the Kotel. There was always a Sephardic father and a son who come together, very well put together, nice dress. And after they'll be done praying, the son would always take his father's hand and
kiss
like,
it. Yeah.
Wow. We never did that in my home, but it was always nice to see that.
Right. I've definitely seen that in Sephardic circles. Not all Sephardic circles, but...
What's the source?
I don't know.
My respect?
Just respect and love and showing affection. You know?
I heard one time, like, when you do that for, like, great rabbis, because they're, like, walking towards the Torah, that if you're kissing the Torah.
Right, in the Hasidic world, they make a big deal of their... I'm not saying that other people don't make a big deal of rabbis, but in the Sephardic and also Hasidic world, they make a really big deal. You know, you're supposed to stand up. I didn't ask anybody to do this with me, but you're supposed to stand up. Like if my rabbi would come... My teacher in Yeshiva University, we always referred to him in the third person. Like I never said, Rabbi, I never would talk to him straight. I would always say, and it was weird in the beginning, but everyone just did it. It's a sign of respect. It's very old school. It's not as fashionable today. All right, let's get back to the bread here, okay? Two loaves of bread. Why two loaves of bread? Yes?
Because there's extra manna.
Okay, good. The bread is supposed to symbolize the man that fell from the heavens. That's the way our ancestors survived what they ate for 40 years in the wilderness. There were no 7-Elevens in the desert, right? So they needed food. God dropped them on, and where's the double portion? Because on God told them not to go out on what day to get the man?
Shabbat.
Not to collect it on Shabbat. So what would they eat? Because the man went wormy every day. It was really a way of developing faith in God. You know, there were no bank accounts, so to speak. No savings accounts in the wilderness. You had to
basically eat what God gave you that day, and then if God gave you food the next day, you had what to eat. If you didn't, you didn't. That's how they developed real faith in God. So what did Hashem say to do? If don't collect it on the seventh, what were they going to eat on Shabbat? Double portion. When? When was the double portion of bread? Not on Shabbat.
Just before.
Right, the sixth day. Sixth day, I'm saying back in the wilderness, the sixth day there was a double portion of man that fell from the heavens, and to remember that we have a double portion of bread at our table. You had a different question?
You say we're supposed to do have bread after we do Kiddush, right?
Right.
What about Nitzilah at night?
I'll get to that in a second. Okay, so, all right, I'll get to it now. So before you eat bread, you're supposed to wash your hands. Anybody know why? How many of you guys had to wash your hands before you came to the dinner table growing up? Anybody? Oh, a few people, okay. I thought it was just us German Jews who made us wash our hands. So there is an idea of washing your hands before you break bread. It is not because of cleanliness per se. It's because who else would wash their hands before they ate food? Anybody know? In Jewish history, the Kohanim, the Jewish priests, would wash their hands before breaking, not just bread, for eating what was called in Hebrew the truma. I know I'm throwing a lot of information out tonight. Don't worry about getting it all. But the priests could not own land, the Jewish priests, and they subsisted based on the truma, the tithing of each Jewish person's crops. So every Jew had crops, whatever it is, in an agricultural society, they would tie the crop, give it to the Kohen. The Kohen had to wash his hands before eating it. Why? Because the food was considered pure and holy, as it represented the people's support for the temple service. So the food got elevated to a very high spiritual status. Even though it's just regular food, it represented the people's love for God, their desire that the temple service and the Kohanim be sustained, and therefore the food took on something. Now, why am I sharing this? Because that's what a meal is in Judaism. It's not just food. And that's why I really think the food tastes different on Friday nights. You ever eat like gefilte fish on a Friday night and then eat it on a Tuesday night? It's much better Friday night. That's because it's probably left over on Tuesday night. But it's really better because there's something different about the way you're eating. See, when you eat, not to simply biologically survive, but you eat because you want to connect to something greater, the food tastes much better. Because it's going towards not only the body, but the soul. And that's why we're washing our hands. And that's why the table, anybody know why we salt the bread also when we get there? Well, technically, because it just tastes better.
It used to be really expensive.
Salt, right? But it's to bring out the taste, but also the sacrifices were salted. And the table is considered like an altar. That's why you're not technically allowed to sit on a table. I remember when I was in high school, I was sitting on a table instead of a chair, and the rabbi got very upset with me. He's like, the table's an altar. I was like, no, it's a table. No, it's an altar, and it represents something holy, where offerings were brought. And the whole Shabbos meal is transformed from this just like dinner to Shabbat dinner. There's a big difference between dinner and Shabbos dinner. Just, it's completely different. Yeah. Yeah, some people go a little crazy with this. So if you take the two challahs and you pick them up and you make the blessing, so you're not supposed to interrupt between the blessing of something and then the activity to which the blessing is connected. So you're making, what's the blessing you make over the challah? Baruch atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech Haolam, blessed are you, God, King of the world, Hamotzi Lechem, God who brings forth bread, min ha'aretz, from the ground. So you're not supposed to, once you make that bracha, you got to gobble it up. I mean, gobble, you have to eat. You're not supposed to. So some people want to reduce the amount of what's called a hefsek, an interruption, between the blessing and the eating by having a little sliver already cut. So if it's a little cut, then the knife can go right in and cut it faster as opposed to starting from scratch. That's the idea. That's the technical idea. By the way, why don't we cover the challah? So the bread does not get jealous. Really? Is that what's happening here? We're now concerned about the feelings of the bread? Is this true?
I'll tell you a story. I'm sorry I'm going late today, but I went over. I hope it's okay. By the way, we're continuing next week. Okay, we're gonna do. We'll tell you in a minute, but we're finishing up soon. I know it's getting late. What's the idea with not embarrassing? What's the technical reason we cover the challah? Technical reason, you know?
Because we have two mitzvahs.
Good.
You want to take advantage of both of them and not just.
Well, right. If you have two mitzvot, what's the problem? You're not allowed to pass up a mitzvah. I don't know if you've ever seen this, but if you ever. You're not supposed to be like, you're not supposed to, like, say, invite somebody to a bris, for example.
Yes.
They let people know when the bris is. They don't say, would you like to come? Can you make it? Please RSVP. Why? Because let's say you can't make it. What are you really saying? No, I'm not going to do this mitzvah. You don't want to put someone in a position where they're not keeping a mitzvah. Because mitzvot are like God's invitation for a relationship. I'm not really interested in that right now. Can't do that. So what's the problem? We have the chalot on the table, and we have the kiddush on the table. By definition, you're going to be passing up one of those mitzvot. You can't do both at the same time. So what do? We cover the challah. Out of sight, out of mind. It's like it's not there. That's the technical reason. What is this idea of not embarrassing?
Hey, Rav Ross, how is that the same thing with, like, you're invited to go to a certain, like, 7th degree, but you don't have the obligation to do it, because it's not your son.
It's still a mitzvah to attend. It's still a mitzvah. You're attending a sudat mitzvah. You're participating, even though you're not the one, you know, doing the actual, you know, mitzvah. You're still part of it.
So theoretically, this just came to mind. If, let's say, you're a Jewish male and you have a fill-in in front of you and the opportunity to write a sacred Torah, like a Torah scroll, you have to, like.
Yeah, that we do that all the time. That's why if you take out the wrong tefillin, like you're supposed to take out the shel yad, the arm tefillin before the head tefillin.
Right.
So then if you take out the wrong one first, you're supposed to cover the other one. Again, so you're not rejecting another. But the other idea that you mentioned about embarrassing, there's a famous story about a guy, a chassid, who had one dream, and that was to have his great Hasidic master come and join him and his family for Shabbat meal. And he invited this person for months and months, and finally the Rebbe, the great Hasidic master, said he would come with his family and join his student at his Shabbat table. His student was already a married person with his own children, and he drove his wife crazy. Everything has to be perfect. The Rebbe's coming. It's going to be a beautiful, beautiful meal. And they go and they make kiddush. Then everybody goes into the kitchen. They wash their hands. They come out. And the gentleman, the student, had the chalot laid out for his Rebbe to make the hamotzi of. And the Rebbe was looking for the salt. He couldn't find the salt. And the man went crazy. Started yelling at his wife. He's like, I told you, I can't believe this. Everything we said has to be perfect. The Rebbe doesn't have a salt. This is terrible. The Rebbe. So after the Rebbe ate something, because he's not supposed to speak, and he ate something, he turned to his student. He says, tell me, what's the reason we cover the challah? So the guy says, what's the reason? Okay, every fifth grader knows the reason we cover the challah is not to embarrass the wine. He says, the wine you're concerned about, and your own wife, you just berated your wife in front of everyone at the table. You know, so the whole idea behind covering the challah is we don't think inanimate objects have feelings, but once we start becoming sensitive even to an inanimate object, it's supposed to make us feel like how much more so should we be concerned with, God forbid, insulting or offending another human being. All right, let's finish up Shabbat. We have, how many meals do we eat on Shabbat? Oh, by the way, what else do you do during that meal after you broke your bread? What else do you do during the meal that's special in honor of Shabbat? Come on, you've been to a Shabbat meal. What else happens? You talk, you hang out.
Bench.
We recite Berakat HaMazon, that's at the end. What else? What do you do before you finish? We eat, what kind of foods?
Fish.
Try to eat like good foods, like the best foods, like in Europe. Our great-grandparents didn't have meat, probably never ate red meat, and maybe they had chicken on Shabbos. But people would save it. So you're trying to save the best for Shabbat. Good. And what else happens at the meal? Somebody shares some words of Torah, maybe about the parsha of the week. What's that? Words of Torah. Sing a song. We have beautiful Jewish songs, Shabbat songs. Try to really make it festive. Try to make it wonderful. And then we recite Berakat HaMazon. How many of these meals do we have every Shabbat? technically three, Friday night, Saturday, and then a third meal, if you can eke out a third meal towards the end of the day. And of course, MG has great Shabbat morning services. You're all welcome to come here any Saturday morning at 9:30. They're very uplifting. We just started doing some great Jewish a cappella stuff. We have a hot kiddush social hour afterwards. A little commercial for MGE on Shabbat morning. Finally, by the way, if you would like to know how to wash your hands for the Motzi, you can take this packet home. Look at the back page on 12. Washing of the hands, partaking of the bread. I go through all the steps and the reasons why we wash our hands before eating bread. And then finally, how do we conclude Shabbat? We brought in Shabbat through the lighting of the candles. How do we take it out? We don't just say goodbye. We escort, just like we brought the Shabbat in like an honored guest, we escort the guest out through the Havdalah. Take a look at the Havdalah. What does the word Havdalah actually mean? It means to separate. To be able to tell the difference between night and day, between good and bad, between holy and regular. That's a very, very important thing, to be able to define different parts of our lives. We're now in a class. We're sitting here, we're focused on these beautiful ideas. We're trying not to do other things. We think we can multitask. We think we can do 15 things at the same time. We like to think we're doing that, but we're not. We're not getting the same thing out of those activities. Now, Shabbat is coming to an end. We're going to escort it out, and we're going to then go back to the regular. And that's really important, to make that demarcation. Take a look on page 11. Candles given to one of the members of the household to hold while the Havdalah is recited. There's a beautiful song that people sing in the beginning. It's just a custom. The real mitzvah of Havdalah is to make a blessing over wine. Again, we do it over wine. If you don't have wine, you can use beer. Just changes the blessing a little. From Bori Pir Geffen to Shahakol. And then why do we have spices at Havdalah? Sniff a little spices. What's the deal with that? Any idea?
I don't remember, but I still have mine from the retreat.
Right. So why do we smell? First of all, some people say, what are the three things we do? First, Bori Pir Geffen, which is taste. Then we smell with our noses. And then we look at the candle with our eyes. So the Kabbalists teach that we're really going up in Kedushin, in sanctity, literally on our own face. And the reason we smell spices is because we're a little sad. Why are we sad? The Shabbos is leaving. And there's a part of our soul that departs. The rabbis teach that there's an neshama yetzera, there's an additional soul. Maybe it's another dimension to the existing soul that enters our bodies on Shabbat to be able to appreciate the added spirituality of the day. And that soul is beginning to depart. And we smell something nice just as a way of comforting ourselves because we're upset. That we're in this like spiritual high, and now life has to kind of go back to normal, if you will. And then we recite the blessing. That's Borei Bnei Bisamim. Blessed is God, King of the Universe, who creates spices. Bless you, and you can use any spices in your home. And then we do with the blessing over the candle itself. We have a tradition that although God created light, the sun on the fourth day of creation, fire was not brought into the world until Motzi Shabbat, until Saturday night. And that's why it's done over a flame. You're in need, what's a flame? At least two wicks. That's the only difference between a Havdalah candle and a Shabbat candle, is that it's two. So if you don't have a Havdalah candle, you can just take two Shabbos candles and put them together, and then you got a Havdalah candle. It's not as nice as, like, you know, the twirl and all that. But we make a blessing over Be'orei Ha'esh, God who creates the lights of the fire. And then finally, take a look at the last blessing. Blessed are you, God, King of the Universe, who makes a division between sacred and secular, between light and darkness, between the Jewish people and the rest of the nations of the world, between the seventh day and the six working days. Blessed are you, God, who makes a distinction between the sacred and the secular. What do we wish each other? After Shabbat, you could either say Shavua Tov, should be a good week, or if you want to get like really fancy and be a little Yiddish, you can say a good vach. Vach just means week in Yiddish. And there you have a beautiful Shabbos. I want to mention one last thing before we finish. The beautiful thing about Shabbat, it's got something for everyone. You can be a very holy roller and get into all the intricacies of every one of the 39 acts of work that we discussed before. Or you can do that. Even if you've been keeping Shabbat your whole life, there's always something new to learn about the Shabbos. If you're not doing any Shabbos, you could start by lighting candles. The great Lubavitch Rebbe championed that mitzvah. Tried to get, they still have it in the New York Times, on the bottom of on Fridays. It was the Rebbe's idea to have the time for Shabbat candle lighting. Just to try, because he really believed that we illuminate the world by bringing Shabbos into our own homes. And when you're lighting that candle, you're not just illuminating your own home, but you're really bringing light to the world. Because the more we all have Shabbos in our lives, the more it transforms us, makes us into the better versions of ourselves, and that, of course, makes a big difference. And I mentioned before that when you make Avdallah, a little extra wine so it overflows. You want that blessing to flow into your week. And that's what I'll leave you with, which is that pick something of Shabbos. It could be the candles, it could be the Kiddush, it could be the double portion of bread, it could be a song. Maybe you're doing all this already, but you don't sing at your Shabbat table. Start singing a little. Or, what do you do Shabbat afternoon? Why did the Great Lawn become such a social scene on Saturday afternoons in Central Park? Because there is an idea of taking a Shabbat walk or a Shabbat nap. That sounds silly. Why is a grown adult taking a nap in the middle of the day? Well, you wake up early, come to shul, pray, eat a lot at the Kiddush, then go to someone's home and eat a big lunch. And by the time you're done with a long lunch, you're tired. You take a little nap. That's what ends up happening. And there's something about that nap, it's very rejuvenating. And it's just being. Shabbat is the one day of the week where we're just being. We're not thinking about anything. We're just existing. And I want to really conclude, I know I've concluded at least 7 or 8 times tonight, I'm going to conclude with one last story. It's my favorite Shabbos story that I heard from Marianne Williamson. This is so powerful. She's a radio talk show host. You know Marianne Williamson, anybody? What's that?
Yes, she is.
She's
yes,
Jewish.
She is Jewish, yes.
Really?
She's just an observant.
But you got to hear the story. It's a beautiful story. She was like on a panel about Shabbat, and she said she was in downtown Michigan sitting next to her 8-year-old daughter. This is a number of years ago. And her daughter was like playing a video game on her computer. They were listening to some music in the background and watching a movie, because you'll see 8-year-old kids can't just do one thing now. And she was answering some emails on her laptop. And the mother and daughter, doing their work side by side. And bam, everything goes off. The computers just shut off. All the lights go off. The electricity just comes down. There's a blackout in Detroit. And the little girl just gets very nervous. She's 8. She's never been through a blackout before. So what do you do when it's so dark and there's nothing? So she ran around the house, looked for a candle, and lit the candle. And the mother and the daughter just sat there with the candle. And they just started to talk. There was nothing else to do. 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 20 minutes go by, and they're just sitting and talking with this candle. And then, bam, everything goes back on. The lights, the electricity. The little girl gets back on her computer. Mom gets back to her emails. About 5 minutes later, the little girl turns to her mother and she says, "Mommy." And the mother's like, "Yes." "You think we'll ever get that chance again?" And the mother's like, "What?" "You think we'll ever be able to talk like that again? That was fun. We never do that." An 8-year-old can tell the difference with her mother in terms of what real quality time is. Ultimately, Shabbos is a forced blackout, because let's face it, we're not going to do it ourselves. We're not that disciplined. It's basically an imposed spiritual blackout to allow us to hear ourselves, to allow us to hear each other, and to be able to think a little about our lives and examine them, look at them, ask ourselves, how are we doing? How do I want to proceed? And in being able to have that, those few minutes, that those 24 hours every week, my mother of blessed memory used to say this. She's like, "I don't understand how people can live without Shabbat." You only know that once you start doing it, though. And you start having that in your life a little. And that's really my blessing to all of us, is to find a little Shabbos for yourself. It's the greatest thing you can do for yourself. And the rabbis talk about the Sabbath as being such a bracha. I call it, we sing it on L'chadodi on Friday nights. We say that it is the makor shel bracha. It's literally the source of all blessing to have that quality time. I thank you guys for listening. Sorry I went over tonight. I really appreciate you guys staying here. We're going to continue next week. You're all welcome to come back. We're starting a new series called
Finding the Holy in the Holidays. Okay. November 8th is what is holy.
Okay, so that's next week. We're going to have a class about the concept of what's called Kedusha, holiness. The reason we're doing this is because Thanksgiving's coming up, Hanukkah's coming up, and we've got some great holidays, and I want to talk to you about the Jewish idea behind Thanksgiving, which is all about gratitude. And we're going to have two classes about Hanukkah as well. And next week we're going to focus on the concept of sanctity and holiness as it relates to all these holidays. So we hope you guys will continue to come back. Thank you for being here, everyone. Pleasure. Please eat some more food. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you,
Rabbi. Pleasure. You're welcome anytime, seriously. Wait, my pressing stopped? Do you know what I do with this?
Oh,
okay. Because it's still
on.
Off? I didn't. I'm not sure.
I'm going to give it to Vinny. I'm just going to stop.
Okay, you're good?
Yeah.